Goeiemiddag dames en here. Ons kan begin, jy's op die mikrofoon. Baie welkom, ons is heeltemal oorweldig om so 'n groot gehoor hierso te sien. Ek is Annemarie Kotse en ek is hier as die gespreksleier, maar ook in my hoedanigheid as die voorsitter van die departement antieke studie. En my gespreksgenote is Jo Marie Klaasen, wat 'n emerita professor van die departement is. En dan drie collega's wat hier so die jeug en die toekoms van die departement verteenwoordig. Samantha Masters, Flip Bosman en Amy Daniels. So hulle gaan elkeen oor hulle hoofstuk in die boek iets sê en Amy namens die redakteur. Die boek wat ons bespreek is geredigeer deur Grant Parker. Hy is 'n professor by Stanford Universiteit in die VSA, maar Grant het in die Kaap groot geword. Hy is 'n Kaapenaar en hy is 'n buitengewone professor by die departement antieke studie en hy besoek ons gereeld en werk saam met ons. Dit spreek nou natuurlik vanself hoekom hierdie boek vir ons as departement naby aan die hart lê. Want ons wy elke dag van ons lewe aan konfrontasies met die antieke wêreld, wat ons nou nie meer so graag die klassieke noem nie, maar die antieke wêreld. En ons is baie passief vol oor wat gebeur wanneer 'n mens oor die antieke begin praat. En dit wil ek graag stel.
Hey, jy vra dit, nou as ek net weet om die ding reg aan te stuur.
Jy moet daar die knoppie daai.
Daai ene. Ook nie? Ek moet probeer weer. Daar is... Toe ek onlangs, no it's alright, it'll do itself. Toe ek onlangs vir 'n vriendin vertel van vandagse boekbekendstelling by die woordfees, toe vra sy verbaas, maar wat het die Griekse en Romeinse oudheid dan met Suid-Afrika te doen? My kort antwoord was, kyk om jou in Stellenbosch rond. Kyk na die Griekse suile van die stadsaal, die ou hoofgebou, na die klassieke voorkoms van baie Kaaps-Hollandse huise en ook ander universiteits- en dorpsgeboue. En my man voeg toe vinnig by en kyk net hier om die draai van ons huis af, die Romeinse tempelhuis wat verlede jaar voltooi is. Sien jy die datum? O ja, sê sy tevrede, dis 2017 daai in Latijn.
Die tweede vraag natuurlik wat ek sou gevra het is, hoekom is daar op die voorblad van hierdie boek swart Suid-Afrikaners in snaakse bont kostuums? Hoe wat het dit met die klassieke of die antieke wêreld te doen?
Dis jong swart akteurs wat die koor van fools in Roy Sargent se opvoering van 'n Griekse komedie uitmaak in die opening openlug klip amfitheater by Kirstenbosch. Dit was in 2005. Sargent beskryf die opvoering in hoofstuk 16 in 'n afdeling van die boek getiteld After Apartheid. Die jong akteurs staan midde in die antieke Griekse tradisie met hulle foolsnavel maskers. Soos die antieke Grieke het die Kaapse gehore dit vreeslik geniet om vroeg in die oggend te gaan en die opvoering te sien hoe die natuurlike sonlig en die flitende skaduwees 'n hele ander dimensie aan die opvoering gee. Gehore kon ook ervaar hoe die antieke gebruik van tragiese maskers 'n element van tydlose universaliteit gee aan twee ernstige Griekse tragedies wat in vorige seisoene opgevoer is. Die tweede hoofstuk in hierdie selfde afdeling wys hoe direk die ewig menslike dilemma's wat deur Griekse tragedies uitgebeeld word vir hedendaagse Suid-Afrika relevant is. Jael Faber se Molora is 'n aanpassing van die oerverhaal van moord, wraak, vergelding en vergifnis soos beliggaam in die mite oor die moord op koning Agamemnon deur sy vrou Clytemnestra en die wraaklus van hulle twee kinders Orestes en Elektra. Molora beteken as, verbrande hout, ash. Grepe uit die verskriklike onthullings voor die waarheids- en versoeningskommissie is binne hierdie raamwerk opgevoer met tussenin die Griekse drama en dan hierdie grepe. Met in die agtergrond 'n koor van kombersgekrede swart moeders wat ween oor die uitgebeelde marteling van hulle kinders onder die apartheidsregime. Die onverwagte slot, heel anders as die klassieke een, is vergifnis van Elektra deur haar kinders en dit het gewys op die moontlikheid van heling en versoening wat die kommissie aan alle Suid-Afrikaners gegee het.
Jammerie, dat dink ek wys vir ons die soort van konfrontasies met die antieke, die klassieke, wat moontlik is. Jy is die een wat die boek die beste ken, kan jy dalk vir ons iets sê oor die verskillende afdelings?
Ja, die afdelings, behalwe Grant Parker, die redakteur se grondige inleiding en slotbeskouing, wat deur my kollegas, kollega Amy toegelig sal word, word 16 hoofstukke, al altesaam 5 ander afdelings ingedeel, wat onderwerpe soos argitektuur tot politiek, regspleging tot ideologie en verder dek. Sy saamgestelde bibliografie gee beeld van hoe wyd hierdie afdelings tesame reik, met skrywers uit uiteenlopende sfere van Nelson Mandela tot die klassikus Theo Harof en titels wat wissel van Papenfoes se Pik Botha and His Times tot Thabo Mbeki se I Am an African toespraak. Mostert se gedenkboek van die ossewaans op die pad van Suid-Afrika en Mylum se The Cult of Rhodes, Remembering an Imperialist in Africa. In Parker se eerste afdeling, Conceiving Empire, wat merendeels gaan oor Suid-Afrikaanse argitektuur, kom Rhodes se naam telkens voor, maar ook die 19e eeuwse Britse idee van hulle empire as 'n voortsetting van en natuurlik 'n verbetering op die Romeinse Ryk. Rhodes se naam kom ook noodwendig in die volgende afdeling voor, Conceiving the Nation, in 'n hoofstuk oor Gerard Moerdijk se poging om van klassieke invloede weg te kom met sy voortrekke monument, wat egter binne-in in die groot saal 'n verhalende vries het wat sterk herinner aan soortgelyke storievriese uit antieke Griekeland en Rome. Ongelukkig was hierdie boek reeds ter perse toe die Rhodes Must Fall beweging vlam gevat het, anders was daar nou nog byvoegings by die boek.
Ja, hierdie konfrontasie is iets wat ons miskien teen die einde tyd sal hê om iets oor te sê. Maar kan jy vir ons nog iets sê oor van die ander onderwerpe wat in die boek behandel word?
Ja, een afdeling getitel Law, Virtue and Truth-Telling bespreek eerstens weer die idee van empire, hier binne die gedagtegange van uiteenlopende denkers soos Rhodes, sy vriend Rudyard Kipling, professor Theo Harof en die filosoof Martin Versveld. Nog 'n hoofstuk deur oudregter Dion van Sail toon die invloed van die Romeinse reg op Suid-Afrikaanse regspleging tot en met ons grondwet. My twee kollegas sal verder uitwy oor hulle bydraes in ander afdelings.
Ja, ek dink dit gee al 'n aanduiding van die vele fasette van die antieke as 'n mens net na die opskrifte kyk. Jomarie, wil jy nie net vir ons oor jou eie hoofstuk in die boek ook
ja,
sê?
Myne is een van die 4 hoofstukke in die afdeling getiteld Boundary Crosses, 'n reeks biografieë onder andere van die vurige Ierse patriot, klassikus en uitgespreke kommunis Benjamin Farrington, professor van Latijn aan die Universiteit van Kaapstad in die 1920s, en daar is ook 'n hoofstuk oor die skryfster van romans uit die Griekse oudheid Mary Renault, wat in Kamsbaai gewoon het. Oor my onderwerp het ek reeds voorheen by die woordfees gepraat, 'n aantal jare gelede. Dis die lewensverhaal van die eerste swart klassikus in Suid-Afrika, die beminde professor Davidson Don Tengu Jababu van Fort Hare. Hy was die seun van 'n welvarende koerantman van King Williamstown, wat self in die 1880s die tweede swart gematrikuleerde was in Suid-Afrika. Nee, nou het die ding te vinnig voor en toe gegaan, kan ek teruggaan?
Ja.
Daar is hy. Die jong DD is te ver siende paard om levenslang beywer vir 'n native college. Destijds was dit 'n aanvaarbare term. Hy het sy seun laat opvoed om daaraan deel te hê. Hy het vir DD 'n paar jaar lank in Lesotho toe gestuur om as Xhosa-spreker ook Sotho te leer praat. Op sy treinreis heen en weer deur die Vrystaat het die verwoesting en ontreddering van die Anglo-Boereoorlog die jong seun aan die hart gegryp en hy was altyd baie simpatiek teenoor teenoor Afrikaners. Hy is toe dan verder aan Lovedale College studeer en toe wou sy pa hê hy moet in Dale College in King Williamstown matriek voltooi, maar rasisme het hom daar uitgehou. Vir die volgende 9 jaar was die in Brittanje eers matriek op Colwyn Bay in Wallis en toe die universiteite van Londen en Birmingham waar hy onderskeidelik 'n Latijn BA en 'n onderwysdiploma verwerf het. En voor sy terugkeer is DD na die Tuskegee Instituut in die VSA om die opvoedkundige metodes van die befaamde swart hervormer Booker T. Washington te bestudeer. Booker T. Washington het ook geglo aan landbou. So sy studente en toe Jabawusen ook het gehelp bou aan die tuine van die universiteit of die college waar hulle was. In elk geval thuis gekom, het Donaldson Don Jabavu in 1915 een van 3 docente aan die nuutgestigte Fort Hare Native College begin werk, as met opdrag Latijn en al die Afrika tale wat hy geken het, en informeel ook directeur van muziek. En hy het ook daar sit hy al weer af. Toe hy sal hard praat.
Is
hy nou weer aan?
Nee.
Jababa was bevriend met Jan Hofmeyr en sympathiek teenoor Afrikaners, maar hy het hom beywer vir die politieke en opvoedkundige opheffing van swart mense. Hy was belangrik en invloedryk in alle besprekings oor politieke vryheid, maar sy politieke gematigdheid het die vuur vreter politici van die struggle nie aangegaan is staan nie en hy is later as het ware as politieke beïnvloeder bevraagteken. Terselfde tyd het sy liberale witvriende hom ook gedeeltelik in die steek gelaat, 1937 met Herzogse verandering aan die politiek daar. Sy politieke invloed het teen die laat 30er jare onder hom uitgeloop. Maar deze grootste bydra was egter sy blootstelling van jong swart intellektueles nie net aan Latijn nie, maar aan alle aspekte van internasionale kultuur, insluitende opera en drama. Onder DD's studente was natuurlijk Nelson Mandela, maar net vir 'n kort rukkie, en ZK Matthews, oupa van minister Maledi Pandor, wat ook later rector van Fort Hare was. Ook natuurlijk Robert Mugabe, en Chris Hani, baie uiteenlopend. Jababu was ewe thuis onder die grootstes van die land en die eenvoudigste mense uit sy Ooskaapse taalgenote. Ek eindig met 'n uittreksel uit my slot. In her second book, his daughter Noni describes an idyllically pastoral vignette. Her then 70-year-old father and an uneducated friend of his youth were sitting together on their porch, overlooking the rolling landscape, comparing notes on matters agricultural. Says Jababu to his old friend, "If you had been taught Isi Latini, I would recite passages in that golden tongue. Roman warriors conquering the whole world chewed grains of boiled maize." "When I taught our young men and women Latin at Fort Hare, construe, translate, this food, zinc orbe, they would say, 'So these Romans were people like us?' And I would reply, 'You are people like the Romans were.' Replies his amazed companion, 'The Romans of the Holy Bible? Ama Roma?' Both venerable men then lapsed into a ruminative silence."
Baie dankie, Tamarie, vir jou interessante blik op die boek. Ons volgende spreker is Amy Daniels, my collega op die punt, en sy gaan namens Grant praat, wat nie vandag hier kan wees nie, en ek dink dit is ook baie gepas, want Grant is 'n gespreksgenoot vir Amy, nie net informeel nie, sy het ook formele onderhoude met hom gevoer, wat mense op podcasts kan luister, en sy sal dan heel gepas praat. Something about the diversity of the contributions in the book, you have to say something.
Well, before I say anything about the diversity, it's just sort of standing in for Grant Parker. It's a bit of a mind bend and a great honor. I don't think I would have had it in me to bring together such diverse writings, such diverse contributions, and to edit them together in a way that makes complete sense. It's just amazing. But in all honesty, I don't think a volume of this nature could have been produced any other way. I mean, our relationship with classical antiquity as South Africans is a multifaceted one. It's one that, I suppose, in the first place, has a history which is, or an interaction that's fraught with tension and difficulty. One need only think of the early Dutch settlers and the way they used Roman statutes to control their often classically named slave population. I don't know if any of you know anyone called Cupido, Julius, or Julius Titus. Right? These are all slave names based on with roots in the classical world. So our heritage or our introduction to classical antiquity is one that's quite problematic. And I think it's for this reason that the international publisher we have was so keen on the subtitle Confrontations. And rightly so, although Confrontations necessarily leads, I don't know for you, but leads to connotations or associations with something negative, with conflict. And I think many of my colleagues and those contributors to the book, they do grapple with this very problematic legacy in different chapters. But I've been thinking a bit more about confrontations and what they necessarily lead to. They necessarily lead to some sort of resolution, no? Let me illustrate it anecdotally. During a correspondence with former President F.W. de Klerk, Grant Parker was informed of a really unexpected and strange confrontation between South Africa and the classical world. The year's 1991, and the ANC, including Nelson Mandela and Chris Hani, who was then chief of Umkhonto weSizwe, were in talks with the National Party at Diefmalan Airport. Now, you may not know this, although my colleague Jo Marie has touched on it somewhat. Chris Hani nurtured a love of Latin and of English literature throughout most of his adult life. In fact, his daughter writes fondly of her father as a scholar in her book released last year. Now, during the tea break, during these negotiations, Chris Hani and Paolo Jordan walk up to Gerrit Viljoen. Now, Gerrit Viljoen was once chair of the Broederbond, and at the time of the meeting, he was Minister of Constitutional Development in de Klerk's cabinet. But he was also a former Greek professor at UNISA and one of the founders of RAU. And the topic of their conversation was Sophocles' tragic play, Philoctetes. Can you imagine the tension that must have buzzed in the room that day? And yet, leaders from the opposing sides were able to build a bridge through their mutual appreciation of a classical Greek play. I'm not saying that Sophocles somehow is responsible for bridging a seemingly impossible impasse. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that something too ancient to be truly offensive, but something all parties could engage in on a personal and intellectual level, may have contributed to those negotiations and to them seeing each other as people. The episode for me is an example of what South African confrontations with classical antiquity have the potential to be, to offer to those who are willing to engage. And indeed, I'm going to read this because it's again in the words of Grant Parker during a recent interview. He says that the questions we as researchers ask are our bridges of imagination, our bridges of human sympathy, and I believe that Chris Harney, Gerrit Viljoen, and the other contributors to this volume dared to ask questions about antiquity that could build bridges. So that's kind of what I feel about the diversity of this book.
Thank you, Amy. I know that the bridges is a concept that is quite dear to you. Do you think that this book can actually contribute to building bridges in South Africa, and how?
I'm glad you asked. Because we find ourselves at an interesting moment in South African history, don't we? It's a moment in our history when South Africans are grappling with what it means to have national identity. It's a moment where we question the place of statuary in the public sphere, statuary that often draws on classical visual language and iconography. And it's at a moment where we're seeking to acknowledge and to engage and to give primacy, rightly so, to indigenous stories. At this moment, it's become increasingly important, for example, that I am clear on what I can offer, even as somebody who spends her time engaging and getting lost in ancient Roman cultures and literatures. It's sort of become increasingly important that I guide my students in a direction where their studies of the Greco-Roman world and North African antiquity add to the ways that they choose to engage in current South African discourses. And I think my colleague's book touches on diverse topics in line with my agenda, for lack of a better word. And looking forward further afield, perhaps into the realm of classics as an academic pursuit, as a discipline, the book gathers South African voices to offer South African interpretations and contributions to the field. And that's worth doing. I don't know if you'd agree with me. And then on another equally important level, I feel like the contributions to this volume offer South African interpretations of classical antiquity and throw spotlights on instances where South Africans have used their knowledge of and their access to the Greco-Roman world with great effect, even as tools of resistance. I think of one anecdote in Grant's introduction where he talks about Albie Sachs finding some writing on a prison wall in Latin. And he answers in very poor Latin. But, I mean, this, I would say, adds new dimensions both to the cultural histories of South Africa but also the cultural histories of the classical world, these new bright interpretations. And then, again, I just want to add something Grant said during my podcast interview, is that we need to have open conversations at this very critical moment in South African history. Open conversations. And I feel this book shows a need, from my very biased opinion, for openness to the unexpected influence of the Azanian muse. That's actually the title of his introduction. As we navigate our national identities and seek to embody the te e karate of our coat of arms, diverse people uniting, or more literally, people who are different meeting. I mean, it's all about bridges, man.
Thank you, Amy, very much for your eloquent answer. Samantha is another author, and she has worked about collections of antiquity in South Africa. Can you tell us something about the focus of your research on this?
Sure. So my chapter is in a section which is called Cultures of Collecting. So my chapter and several other chapters in the book turn the focus on the material environment of South Africa and looking at visual representations or visual receptions of classical antiquity in South Africa. So Jo Maria has already drawn attention to architecture, for example, And that would be, of course, a very obvious way, area that we find the reception of classical antiquity in the buildings that that we find in many of our cities. Another chapter that is in the same section is on the donation of some casts that were made in to the South African Gallery, the Cape Town Gallery at the time. And these were life-size casts of famous classical sculptures that were donated to South Africa. They were sent from Britain, and they were sent as these marvelous examples of what the real thing would look like. And what Anna Titsa discovers in her chapter is that the reception of these casts was quite problematic and unexpected. So everyone expected that these artifacts or objects that were being donated to the South African Gallery as these pristine examples of classical antiquity donated by the colonial regime, if you like, as perfect examples of what sculpture should be, would be welcomed with open arms. And in fact, this was not the case at all. So this was very unexpected. And in my own chapter, I was interested in looking at collections of artifacts, so nothing on the scale of those classical casts or large-scale sculpture, but smaller items that were donated to South African museums or were acquired by South African museums. And I was interested in the journeys, the kind of biographies of these museum collections. So that's the sort of broad scope of what I was interested in doing. And I had three main purposes for doing this work, or three main questions that I wanted to ask. The first was, what do we have where? So it was a kind of survey trying to discover, well, what do we have? What do we actually have in collections in South Africa? And I noticed that there were two main types of collections that emerged. The one would be state museums, so the old colonial museums, originally colonial museums, such as the South African Museum, which of course then became Iziko, and then on the other hand, university collections. So that was one of my findings, is that we have two main types of collections. And I was surprised to discover how much there actually was. And it was a useful documenting process. But apart from that, I wanted to ask questions about why these objects were collecting, fully expecting to find a really conscious agenda for collecting classical antiquities, expecting that there was an ideological purpose to the collecting, suggesting that, well, classical items would be prized, they were prestige items that would be sought out and deliberately collected by especially colonial museums and probably also in the era of apartheid. And then the third question was, where are they now and what has happened to them post-1994? Because this is one of the things that I discovered, is that very few of the collections are actually still on display.
Mm-hmm. You said you were quite surprised by the practices of collecting. Do you want to say something more about that?
Yes.
Have you covered it?
No. These slides just wanted to point out to the audience that we actually have a collection in our own department, some very nice coins, and also a few other objects. But to get to the question about what was unexpected, so I said that I was expecting to find this conscious collecting drive for classical antiquities, especially in the old colonial museums like South African Museum, Albany Museum in Grahamstown, the Durban Art Gallery. But what I discovered through especially a case study of Iziko was that the collection was acquired in a very haphazard way, that you can find no evidence of a conscious policy of collection of classical antiquities. So curators deliberately wanting to collect these items. So the early colonial museums actually collected almost anything. They mostly received these items, such as so cultural history, let's call it, these items by donation. So it was what people were willing to part with and give to the museum. So very often it was what wealthy gentlemen who had done the grand tour of Europe and had come back with some coins or little vessel or something like that, what they would donate to the museum. Because the museum South African Museum, early South African Museum, didn't have a budget to collect very much. And in fact, I find that they prioritized, if they were collecting, they were prioritizing items of natural history and local, the colony, the natural history of the colony. That's what they were really interested in. So I find that quite unexpected, because I was assuming a much more deliberate policy and a focus on these prestige items, and that doesn't appear to be true at all.
And even under the apartheid era, you might have found some ideological identification with the classics. You did not find that either?
This is what I was expecting, and there was no evidence to suggest that at all. So I, again, couldn't find very deliberate policies of collecting. There were certainly collections that were put on display, and school children would come and have a look at them. And then, of course, we have to think about the audience and who was being brought to see the collections. Mm-hmm. But no particular focus on these items. Mm-hmm. What I did find, which was interesting, was that cultural history and natural history were originally put together in the museum, and when there was a decision made in Cape Town at the South African Museum to separate cultural history and natural history, the items that were associated with local South African traditions, so objects, and even the people themselves, so I'm sure some of you know about the controversial dioramas that were in the South African Museum, which are now no longer on display. So these items, and these, the actual casts of human beings, were left with natural history, and then the items such as Greek pottery and Chinese pottery were moved to a cultural history museum. And so this very clearly does suggest an ideological preference for certain kinds of material, but not only Greek or Roman items, but a so-called division into civilized, the products of civilized societies and not. So, yes, there is a very interesting ideological thing going on, but it wasn't quite at what I expected. Uh-huh. So that's an image of the old South African Museum where everything was displayed together. So items of cultural history, weapons, and then animals, eggs, various kinds of things, which is quite a nice snapshot.
Very interesting. And then, of course, the question is, post-1994, what happened to these objects?
Okay, so I was expecting to find some link with changes in heritage policy, because I did notice that, as I said originally, I uncovered all of these collections, and few of them are still on display. So the ones that are in black are still on display. The others are in storage, or the ones in blue have been donated to another collection. So, I'd say just over half of the collections are no longer on display, and I was expecting to find a correlation with the new government and heritage policies. And to an extent, this is true. These collections, some of them have been put away, and that is because the preference, and I think rightly so, the focus on neglected histories has become much more important. And so I think this is completely makes sense. And this is an example. This is the old Greek room at the South African Cultural History Museum, which has now reverted to the Slave Lodge. So some of you may have even visited that collection. So on the left-hand side, you can see what the room used to look like. And now that space has been reclaimed and has become a museum of slavery. Well, the whole building, of course, has been returned to its original its original identity as a slave lodge. And so the story of slavery is being told, and I think that this displacement of a collection is completely appropriate. And so that collection is now at Zico, it's in storage, and we visit it. I take my students, and we go and visit it from time to time, and Zico are very happy to show people the collection, and they look after it well. So, it happened to be in the space that was needed for something else. And so, yes, there is a correlation to an extent, but not a deliberately, again, targeting of classical objects. Mm-hmm. It's just other stories need to be told. Mm-hmm. And I think that's appropriate.
Absolutely, I agree with you. We can end Samantha's questions on a lighter note with an object she has brought. Will you show us the object? The so-called Zuma pot. So can you tell us something about the Zuma pot?
Just very quickly. So this is one of my favorite items that a student has made, and very luckily she allowed me to keep it because I absolutely love it. I'll give her credit. Her name is Luciana Acquisto. And what this was part of a course on Greek art, reading Greek art. And we were looking at iconography, and we were trying to understand something about signs and what they mean in context. And so I was teaching them that iconography in ancient Greece, if you don't understand the context, you won't understand everything about the image and what it means. And so I set them a task of trying to use that idea of iconography and combine it with something modern and just reflect. And so that's what she did. So she thought about the palette of Greek pottery, the iconography, the type of iconography, and then she, of course, was also inspired by Zapiro and the showerhead and his kind of iconography. And so I just wanted to use this as an example of how we, in our teaching, use antiquity as a lens to look at the current era as well and to think about our own world. And this was, there's Malema as well, and people are very welcome to have a look at it. Of course, that was when he was still part of the ANC, so this is quite a while ago, dressed as a hoplite. And yes, if you would like to look at it afterwards, I'm very happy to show it to you. And then another one very quickly, also a student project, was, okay, now what do we do with all this masculine type of powerful imagery we find in ancient Greece? So on the left-hand side we have the Zeus or Poseidon throwing his either thunderbolt or his trident. And here a student decided to reinterpret this and say, why do these powerful figures always have to be male and always have to be white? And so she depicted a black female nude, which of course in antiquity would be slightly problematic because women must be covered up. And she is holding not a weapon of a traditional sense, but she is holding a scroll. And so education is the power that she is wielding. So I just thought I would reflect a little bit on those bridges, as Amy spoke about, the bridges of antiquity, the present, and how we can play around with ideas and we can reflect on our own world through the past.
I think you've absolutely made clear the imaginative things that can be sparked off by the ancient world. Ja, baie dankie Sam. Ons laaste bydraer vandag is dan Flip Bosman. Flip het navorsing gedoen oor die gebruik van klassieke elemente, inhoud, in die Afrikaanse kinderinsekloopedie. Kan jy vir ons 'n bietjie vertel oor die inhoud van jou artikel daaroor?
Ja, ek dink die klein soektogie waarop ek gegaan het, was dalk die interessantste deel van die hele ondersoek. Dit het begin toe Grant en Rolf Schneider, wat die groot deel geskryf het oor, dink een baie belangrike studie oor die voortrekker monument, was op 'n besoek aan UNISA waar ek gewerk het op die stadium, en hy het toe die project genoem. Dit was my interessant gewees, want duidelijk was Grant se oogmerk nie om 'n doodgewone resepsiestudie te doen van hoe die antieke eenvoudig gereproduceer is of gereageer is daarop nie, maar hy wou hê ons moet kyk na infiltrasies van die antieke in die Suid-Afrikaanse landskap in die algemeen. En hy was op daardie stadium was hy geïnteresseerd in monumentalisering en statues en so aan, maar hy het vir my half oopgelaat en ek wou toe nou eintlik graag gaan kyk het, ek kom bietjie uit 'n literêre familie, ek wou gekyk het na die invloed van die klassieke op die Afrikaanse literatuur, bietjie met my sussie daaroor gepraat, sy het gesê, hoekom gaan kyk ek nie, wat doen Van Wyk Lou met sy inskrywings in die klassieke, oor die klassieke in die kinderensiklopedie nie. Nou, kinderensiklopedie allemaal, ek dink jy, baie van ons hierso ken dit baie goed. En ek het toe gaan kyk na wat Van Wyk Lou skryf, dit was nie vreeslik indrukwekkend nie, maar toe ek nou so begin deurblaai deur die insiklopedie, toe sien ek net hoeveel van hierdie Interessante verwysings na die klassieke vind 'n mens in 'n hele wye spektrum van inskrywings in die ensiklopedie. Toe ek begin navorsing doen, waar kan ek iets meer kry, want ek wil toe nou 'n klein inleidingkie skryf oor hierdie kinderensiklopedie, kon niks kry nie. Naspers gekontak, Frans van Verster het vir my gesê, hoekom gevra ek nie net by die Gerike biblioteek hier by Stellenbosch of hulle nie iets het nie. En ek het vir Mimi Seifert gekontak, en toe ek die oggend hier kom, te staan daar 35 sulke dik lers. Wat toe gebeur het is CF Albertijn, die redakteur van die kinderensiklopedie, het sy hele korrespondensie net so op Stellenbosch Universiteit gedamp, en hulle is nie baie gelukkig daaroor nie, maar hulle was daarom baie bly. Ek was die eerste ou wat dit ooit aangevra het. So, en ek het toe daar 'n bietjie navorsing gedoen, en dit was toe vir my 'n hele interessante speurtog, want al Albertijn se korrespondensie met sy medewerkers en so aan is daarin opgeneem, en hy was kennelik baie, baie trots op hierdie projek van hom. Dit was die grootste publikasieprojek in Suid-Afrika geskiedenis tot op daardie datum, en dit, nadat dit gepubliseer is, het dit natuurlik baie goeie reviews gekry, oral in die pers. Hy het dit ook alles baie sorgvuldig uitgeknip en ingeplak, so ek kon die hele story daar vir hom lees. Dit was natuurlik 'n produk van Afrikaner nasionalisme, hier in die laat 30s, begin 40er jare, die hele idee, hy onderspeel dit 'n bietjie self, Albertijn, in 'n toespraak wat hy later gegee het, maar in private korrespondensie het hy gesê, dit was 'n breinkind van die Broederbond. Hy het dit uitgedink daar op 'n Broederbond vergadering, een keer hier in Kaapstad, met deur 'n man, J. du Preez Scholes, wat later 'n professor in Afrikaans by Aikies was. En dit het vir hulle gegaan, deel van Afrikaner nasionalisme het baie ernstig gegaan oor die opvoeding van die kind, die Afrikaanse kind, in, by wyse van sy eie taal. En van die goed wat 'n mens daar lees, kan ons nog steeds baie aanklank vind, ook in vandagse dekolonisasie debat, want die uitgangspunt was baie duidelik, voete gegrond in Afrika, maar met die oë op die wêreld.
Baie dankie. Kan jy vir ons nog 'n bietjie vertel oor jou bevindinge, wat was die soort inhoud wat die in die ensiklopedie gevind het, hoe dit verband hou met die boek se tema?
Ja, ek het toe baie stelselmatig begin deurgaan, en al die verwysings na die antieke wêreld en veral nou na die Grieks-Romeinse wêreld toe opgeskryf en hulle toe begin organiseer. Albertijn was baie sterk beïnvloed deur 'n Engelse ensiklopedie van daardie tyd, Arthur Mee's Children Encyclopedia. So dis 'n spesifieke tipe ensiklopedie wat nie alfabetiese inskrywings gehad het nie, maar hierdie deurlopende temas wat in al die bande na mekaar gehanteer is, soos julle sal dit dalk nog bekend vind, die aarde waarop ons woon en die wonderlike heelal, die diereryk, die plantryk en so. Dit was 'n baie mooi, wyd verspreide aanbieding van alles wat 'n mens in 'n ensiklopedie sou kon verwag. Nou die groot temas, as julle nou My Big Fat Greek Wedding gesien het, sal julle weet waarvan ek praat. Die groot ding was altyd omtrent alles wat bestaan, kan teruggelei word na die Grieke toe. Hulle was vreeslik idealiserend in daardie dae, ons is nou nie meer so deesdae nie, maar die Grieke was wonderlik. Ek dink hulle dit op universiteit, hulle moes dit op universiteit geleer het, dat die Grieke was eintlik net fantasties. Die Egiptenare was maar 'n bietjie somber, en die Romeine was eintlik maar imperialiste. Hulle het so 'n bietjie hulle mes in vir die Romeine, want hulle herinner natuurlik aan die Engelse op daai stadium. So die Grieke was fantasties, en omtrent alles kan 'n mens na die Grieke toe aflei. Wat vir my interessant was die pedagogiek wat gevolg is. Daar's altyd vir die kinders die storie van iets vertel. Die storie van goud, die storie van oorlogvoering, die storie van die vetstert skaap selfs. So alles het begin met 'n storie van iets, en gewoonlik kry ons dit by die Grieke. Maar dan is daar ook ander tipe inskrywings wat nie net kyk na die oorspronge daarvan nie, maar tipe goed wat van durende waarde was. So dis nie net die dis iets wat nou agterhaal is nie, maar dis iets wat nog steeds in vandagse samelewing van belang is. Onder andere exempla, Alexander die Grote byvoorbeeld in sy hele beskawingstog, wat die Afrikaners moes herinner aan hulle taak hier in Afrika, tipe anekdotes wat die mense oorvertel het. Ek was verstom oor hoe goed onderlê die professore destyds aan Stellenbosch, hoe goed hulle onderlê was in die antieke, en ek dink die rektor is hier, hy moet dit miskien weer verpligtend maak, vir alle akademici om 'n kursus in antieke kultuur by ons te kom loop. Een mens sou kon sê dat in term van die politiek van die tyd, die klassieke wêreld het vir hierdie mense die funksie gehad om die Afrikaner volk te bind aan die groot kultuurvolke van die Grieke en die Romeine, wat nou soort van deur Europa na Suid-Afrika toe gekom het, so dit het 'n identiteitsfunksie gehad, waar wy samehorigheid moes gee vir die Afrikaners, maar ook voorbeelde van waarskuwing. So, mens kry byvoorbeeld die Peloponnesiese oorlog van die Grieke was tussen die twee stadstate, Sparta en Athene, maar in hierdie, in die kinderencyklopedie word het 'n burgeroorlog, wat die Afrikaners waarsku om samehorigheid te handhaaf, en die selfs die verval van die godsdienst op 'n baie vreemde manier word as 'n voorbeeld gehou dat mens moet by jou waardes hou, want as die samelewing eers in duie stort, dan weet mens nie wat kan gebeur nie. Laastens dink ek dat daar het beslis universalistiese en humanistiese perspektiewe deur die verwysings na die klassieke in die denkwêreld van die kinders van Afrikaanse families hierdeur na vore getree, en mens sou hoop dat dit 'n goeie invloed op die lang duur gehad het.
Baie dankie, Flip. Ek weet nie of ons die kamer vinnig moet ontruim nie, is hier iemand wat vir my kan sê. My collega's het toe ons oor hierdie gepraat het gesê, hulle dink daar's 'n olifant in die kamer as ons oor hierdie boek praat, en ek wil net vinnig die olifant by sy naam noem, en as iemand nog tyd het, kan hulle miskien luister na 'n paar perspektiewe wat mense daaroor het, en die olifant is, terwyl die rektor ook hier is, het die onderrig van die klassieke en die antieke wêreld 'n plek aan universiteite in Suid-Afrika vandag. En wat se plek het dit? Amy, I know that you, although you haven't made up your mind, you have a lot of views on this.
I did say to my colleagues that I'm the wrong person to answer this right now, because it is something I'm grappling with in terms of our relevance in sub-Saharan Africa. But this paradigm that Grant has sort of sketched for me, both in conversation and in the book, the one of bridge building, is one that I find really important, because we simply happened to fall in love with ancient Greece and Rome. We could have fallen in love with the Aztecs. We could have fallen in love with ancient China. Okay? But from each of these societies, there's something we can learn in terms of what to avoid, what to do, how they tackled their problems. There's something to appreciate about their humanity and their grappling with the human condition, I think. And so that's my starting point, I think, in terms of teaching my students, also teaching them that the study of classics could be construed as problematic. Why are you doing ancient cultures, first years? Okay. And it's something I'd like them to grapple with from the very beginning as well.
Maybe I can add that Amy has been nominated as a lecturer who inspired one of our best top first-year students the most during her first year, so she obviously has some success with what she does. Sam, did you want to add something? Flip?
Ja, ek dink, mens moet maar net sê dat, ek dink jy het genoem dat ons is voel effens ongemaklik met die term klassieke, want ek dink nie, ons beskou meer die Grieks-Romeinse samelewing noodwendig as normatief nie. Ons beskou dit deesdae meer as 'n instrument waarmee ons dink. Die hele idee van 'n beskawing wat na vore getree het, opgebloei het en verdwyn het, en hy's nou weg. Maar ons kan hom nog steeds ondersoek in terme van die materiële kultuur, in terme van die literatuur wat ons daarvan oor het. Die sofistikasie daarvan is soms tyds verstommend. En ons kan ons kan dit bestudeer, maar met 'n kritiese afstand daarvan. So dit word eintlik in die geesteswetenskap in die algemeen word die antieke wêreld en die Grieks-Romeinse wêreld spesifiek word 'n soort van 'n speelgrond waarop ons kan teorieë toets, nuwe invalshoeke probeer en so aan. En natuurlik ons studente klink vir my altyd, hulle is mal daaroor dat daar so, dat dit juis 'n vak is waar daar soveel verskeidenheid is. So dis nie 'n eng dissipline nie. Dis 'n vak waar jy van filosofie tot filologie, van materiële kultuur tot whatever wat jy ook al daar wil inbring. So dit is 'n baie goeie leerskool vir die teorieë van die geesteswetenskappe. En natuurlik moet ek net byvoeg, dit is ook 'n beste praktyk want die beste universiteite ter wêreld het almal by voor die voet 'n baie sterk klassieke departement.
Baie dankie Flip. Ons sal nou hier nog die spyker inslaan deur vir die rektor 'n boek te oorhandig. Baie dankie vir almal van u wat gekom het. Ons was werklik waar aangenaam verras met so 'n groot gehoor.
Ek wil net sê, dis nou die storie van die ou tannie. Ek het omtrent amper almal in hierdie klas, ag in hierdie kamer, klas gegee, voel dit vir my. Maar ons het jare gelede 'n wonderlike jong student gehad wat toe 'n dosent geword het en sy het baie kort by ons klas gegee en toe is sy oorlede, Fran de Villiers. Sy het 'n klein boetie Wim op skool gehad nog. In gedagte aan Fran.
Baie dankie. Waardeer dit.
Baie dankie. Nou mag ons seker die kamer ontruim. Baie dankie.